Missed out on the summer sports action? Need a quick catch-up? Well, here at URN, we're going to help. For the next 2 hours, our experts will take you through all the action from the last 3 months and answer any questions you have about the world of sport. This is URN Sport.
Hello, yes, welcome to URN Sport, and for the first time ever, we have a very special Sunday sports special lined up for you. I am Jack Newman, I'm going to be your host today, and I'm happily joined here today by Harry, Joe, and David, and what a show we have lined up for you today. We'll be bringing you up to date with all of the major sporting events that have occurred over the summer, with the two tennis majors being played, along with Britain's performance in the Davis Cup. We'll also be reviewing the dominant Mercedes Formula One team and reviewing the Japanese Grand Prix that occurred earlier today. We will take a look at the women's golf with the Solheim Cup taking place between Europe and USA, and also news on the new world number one golfer, men's golfer, Jason Day. Following on from this, we'll be having a look at the topsy-turvy performance from England against Australia in the Ashes and ODI series over the summer. Later on in the show, we'll be reviewing the start of the Premier League season so far and taking a look back to the Women's Football World Cup that occurred in Canada and England's historic performance in the competition. Finally, to round up the show, we'll be talking about the home nations and their performance so far in the Rugby World Cup, and reviewing all of the exciting action from the Athletics, as well as the retirement of Floyd Money Mayweather from boxing.
Tennis.
We're going to start off the show today by talking about the tennis, and of course there was two major championships that happened over the summer. You had Wimbledon at the start of the summer, and then you had the US Open, which occurred just a couple of weeks ago. Now guys, obviously Djokovic beat Federer in the final of Wimbledon. He won that in four sets. Now guys, what are your opinions of perhaps Federer maybe getting on a bit now? Do you think he's, you know, losing a bit of stamina?
You've got to look at the figures there, Jack. I mean, he's certainly towards the end of the sets. Yes, it's against Djokovic, who I've got to say throughout the entire season has played very, very consistently and played very well, of course. But I just think, I mean, Federer's now 34, late 30s, and you've got to see that there are younger players coming through, and I think he is, while he plays lovely tennis, and I'm quite biased because I do like Federer, he plays lovely tennis, he is slightly off the pace of the game, seen in that final.
It's that difference, isn't it, with new sports players maybe being more athletic and maybe more sort of, you know, they have sports scientists and sports coaches now just drilling it into these professionals, you know, especially in terms of tennis, like the speed around the court. You know, I guess it's been in the past with players that they've been very skillful, but maybe not quite as athletic, whereas now I think they're all athletes as well as, you know, able tennis players. I mean, Federer's, you know, a once in a generation, once in a lifetime player. But yeah, it's definitely a case of maybe him not being up to the pace of, say, Djokovic or Murray.
Moving on to then the US Open, where yet again Djokovic managed to beat Federer in the final in four sets and go on to win his second US Open and his 10th Grand Slam title. I mean, you know, Djokovic at the moment, don't you guys think that he's just perhaps a bit unbeatable at the moment? You know, is there anyone that can beat him?
Nadal on clay. Djokovic isn't great on clay, whereas Nadal on a clay court is still the supreme master.
He's just a very, very all-round tennis player, isn't he? I mean, we talk about the athleticism and the skill. Maybe he doesn't quite have the grace that Federer has necessarily, but he's so accurate and so strong in his shots a lot of the time, and such variety as well. I mean, you see him come into the front of the court and from the back, you know, sort of slogging it long and, you know, beating players. So yeah, I think there's that element as well, that he's very complete.
It's obviously not possible to say that he's realistically looking at going an entire year without losing. You know, that can happen, of course, but I still think that at most of the Grand Slams he still has to put in a near superhuman effort to fend off some fantastic players. He still has to play to his best to win.
Now obviously in the US Open as well, you know, where Andy Murray won his first Grand Slam title, he didn't really go so well for him this year. He was out in the fourth round after a defeat against Kevin Anderson. He lost that match in four sets. Again, very disappointing for Murray. Not really a great summer. What are your guys' opinions on how Murray's been playing at the moment? Is there perhaps something to do with, you know, a mismatch in the coaching staff, and maybe Amélie Mauresmo isn't quite a match for him, or is it something else?
I don't think there's a mismatch in the coaching staff. I think Mauresmo has done very well with Murray over the last last year or so. I think he's just in a dip, frankly. He didn't play all that well. He played well in Wimbledon. He got to the semi-finals and was beaten by Federer in a superb game. He then, going into the US Open, the fourth, and I got to say, I did manage to watch that match. Kevin Anderson played a superb, superb game. You've just got to look at the stats and see it went to a tie match. Pretty much three of the five sets went to a tiebreak, which shows that it was exceedingly close. And a tiebreak can, of course, go either way. If you miss a first serve in a tiebreak, you know that you're in for a hard point. If you get it in, it's much easier going, say, okay, that's now 5-4 or 6-5. You think, okay, it's now I've just got one more first serve in. So it's not, I don't think he should be disappointed. I mean, yes, he should be disappointed with the fourth round loss in the US Open, but I think actually he's had a fairly average year.
This is URN Sport.
Formula One.
Okay, so now moving swiftly on, of course, there was a Japanese Grand Prix earlier on this morning at the ridiculous time of 6 a.m. I indeed did wake up. Somehow I managed to wake up and catch most of the race. You know, from what I saw, it was a great, brilliant race. Me and Harry, again, were talking about it before out in the studio. You know, we said that the race was practically over after the second lap, you know, after Hamilton had dove down on the inside after the start.
It's after, like, the fourth corner, I thought. Yeah, yeah. He got out of the blocks. Now it, like, he's gone.
It was an absolutely brilliant start. For those of you who didn't manage to wake up at 6 a.m. it finished with Hamilton finishing first after a brilliant move on the first lap, and then Rosberg had to settle for second and Vettel finished third. Now, just a question to you guys: what do you guys think that Mercedes are doing that makes them so dominant in the races so far? You know, are they doing anything different to the other teams, or is it just particularly the Mercedes engine?
I think it's a mix of the fact that they've got the best car and the best drivers. And that is a combination that can't really be explained in any other way other than that. It is the fact that if you have good drivers and a decent car, you'll do fairly well. If you have the best car but not so impressive drivers, you won't do too well. But they do have, by far and away, the two best drivers, or two of the best drivers. It's a bit hard in a sport like that where you are relying on a piece of kit like a car. But they've got two of the best drivers and they do have the best car.
Now, I mean, obviously this race was Hamilton's 41st career Grand Prix win, and that matches the total that Ayrton Senna managed to get all those years ago. And, you know, do you guys think that Hamilton is sort of Senna-esque? Hamilton's come out and said that Ayrton Senna was his idol when he was young and racing. Do you guys think that perhaps Hamilton is better now than Senna was then, or are the two incomparable in terms of, you know, when they were racing?
You can't compare from the different eras. The cars are completely different, and that's not to say that Senna didn't lead the field of what he had at the time. You can only race with what you've got, but I don't think it's fair to compare, because I think it, unlike in some sports where you can say, well, it's always the same and they're all playing with the same ability, they're all playing with the same football, they've all got the same cricket bats and cricket balls, they don't have the same cars. They are completely different, and whilst Senna was a phenomenal racer, I don't think Hamilton is as good, but that's not to say he's not one of, if not the best of the modern era.
Now, sadly, moving on to some sad news, obviously over the summer, Jules Bianchi had a crash last year in a Japanese Grand Prix, and, you know, he was in a coma for 9 months and he unfortunately passed away. And, you know, there was lots and lots of tributes flooding in from, you know, not just from the Formula One, but from the entire world. You know, he was a young racer, he was up and coming, you know, there was a lot of promise for him. And, you know, it was the first death since, obviously, Ayrton Senna at Imola. You know, what do the FIA need to change about the safety, you know, to try and minimise these risks? Or is there only so much that they can do?
In a way, you're driving a high-powered car at 200 miles an hour, 100 round the corners, roughly, give or take. They have, however, started to change. I had a look yesterday, actually, on the rules coming into... They will be hopefully changing on 2015, 2016. So the main one that struck me was the super license age has gone up to 18. Will go up to 18 in 2016. So that means you have to be over 18. You have to have had 2 years driving at 2 years driving at junior formula level, Formula 2, Formula 3. And there's a whole issue about the helmets and the safety in the car itself, but frankly, if they're going at 200 miles an hour and they hit a barrier, the crumple zone, yes, the crumple zones on those cars are superb. They're meant to give you as much chance of survival as possible. The crash that unfortunately happened in the Japanese Grand Prix was devastating. There's a way, in a fan's eye, certainly hope that they don't try and make it too safe. There's all this this talk about virtual safety cars coming on and there being lap penalty times.
Well, I mean, they already do that this season.
They already do that, and they're thinking of extending it and things. And it's just, I hope they don't lose what everyone thinks of as Formula One, lose the excitement, lose the sort of, you're meant to be on the edge of your seat when they go around the chicane. They're meant to be on the edge of a sheet when you try and turn, when they try and turn through a corner and someone tries a daring overtake. It's part of Formula One, but the death is obviously a tragic, like in any sport.
You're looking forward to the risk and the fact that there might be a collision, there might be an incident, there might even be, you know, a fairly heavy crash, and there's going to be, you always hope at the end of that. Especially the more serious it gets, that the driver's just going to be able to get up out of the car and walk away.
Yeah. I mean, talking of that, obviously in the qualifying session 3, Danny Kvyat, he had an unfortunate crash. He lost the back end around one of the corners, and you know, he went into a roll, and thankfully he managed to walk away from his car.
One of the Russian commentators that I found of that clip online, Danny Kvyat being a Russian driver, one of the Russian commentators just stopped, and the first words after he saw that there was movement in the car was, thank the Lord that nothing more serious has happened, which is probably how most people felt as well.
This is URN Sport.
Golf.
Hello, welcome back to URN Sport. And yes, indeed, we are going to be talking about golf. And now, obviously, I'm not the biggest golf fan, but what I do know is that USA managed to beat Europe 14.5 to 13.5 in the Solheim Cup after trailing 10-6 after the morning's four balls. We have our own resident golfer in the studio in Harry, and there was some controversy on the 17th hole in
there
one of the four
indeed,
balls matches,
Jack,
wasn't there?
There was indeed some controversy on the 17th hole. And I'll try and speak as plainly as possible so that if you don't understand, I understood perfectly when I watched it. But it basically comes down to the USA's putter, putting for birdie, putting to win the 17th, which would put them at 10-7, possibly 10-8. Then if they won the 18th, they'd go 10-8 and give them a better chance of beating Europe. And she putted, she missed the birdie putt, and the European Charlie Hulls walked away, walked to the other side of the green. And Lee took that as a cue. She thought, he said, that's good. Because in golf, if a putt is a certain distance from the hole, your opposition can say, oh, you can have that, or that's good, meaning you don't have to putt it out. And because she's just putting to half the hole, and it means they've basically drawn the hole.
Obviously, the chances of putting such a long putt wouldn't be as high as they would be, so you might as well just concede
exactly.
the hole.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this was 18 inches. This was about a ruler, probably. It was about a ruler length. And the controversy came, and this is where I believe it's bad sportsmanship. And I'll see what you think after I've tried to explain it. The European team said, we said no such thing. They said, we said no such thing. We didn't say that's good. We just walked to the edge of the green. Granted, she walked off at some speed, and her body language was like, oh, we're moving towards the 18th. The umpire then got involved. There are three umpires on the pitch, but the main one got involved and said, he spoke to the caddies, he spoke to the team members, he spoke to the coaches, because it has to have come from an opposition part of the team. It can't have come from the crowd. At which point they took the ruling, and the ruling was that if Charlie Hull's European statement could have reasonably have led Lee to think that her next shot had been conceded, Lee should have then replaced her ball as near as possible to where it lay without penalties. She wouldn't have taken a shot penalty, and she wouldn't have lost the hole. Otherwise, Lee would have incurred a penalty stroke for lifting her ball without marking it. Had she put it up and umpired, seen reason to say that she hadn't, he could have said, right, put your ball nearest where you'd marked it and take your putt. But the main issue with this was the fact that it was miscommunication, and it was also the fact that European, rather than just going with it, because they'd won the hole anyway, rather than just going with it, they said, no, we'd like you to take the putt. It was that bad sportsmanship.
But that doesn't take away from the fact that from what I've understood, and forgive me if I'm wrong, that what we were expecting Europe to do was to say, oh, you know what, they thought that we'd given them the putt because it was 18 inches from the hole. That's fine.
That's fine. And don't complain. The fact that she complained to the umpire saying we didn't tell them anything, and this caused a whole hullabaloo, because the fact that she'd walked
I was going to say, would you understand that if she said, wait, what on earth has happened here, why has she done that, that's different to saying, hang on, she's done that because she thinks I've done, you know, I'm complaining, rather than saying, wait, what's just happened?
Yeah, no, she was complaining.
It was a
complaint that got taken far too seriously, and it put a dampener on the entire day. Yes, USA went on to win it, but there was still that overshadow of what Europe had done, and Europe had to go on and apologise, and it made women golf, the fans get very upset that this had happened, and it's not good for any sport, frankly, when this kind of thing happens.
Now, moving on to, of course, men's golf, and I don't know if you guys know, but we have a new world number one men's golfer in Jason Day. He became number one after winning the BMW Championship by 6 shots in Chicago, overtaking Rory McIlroy. Joe, I was just wondering, what are your opinions on Jason Day, if you've seen much of him, and, you know, what kind of pressures do you think that being world number one at any kind of sport has?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the pressures of being number one is massive. I think Rory McIlroy was obviously up there for a few seasons, wasn't he? He was up there for...
He's been up there for 2 or 3 years now.
Yeah, so obviously he must have, you know, been playing out of his skin, really, and been, you know, accurate on the course to knock him off that top spot. Yeah, and I guess now it's a case of him sort of wanting to stay there, really. And yeah, and you're performing well, I think, is the key.
In a sense, I agree. How long he'll stay number one for, I expect at least a year, until the Masters and the rest of the PGAs restart again, purely because golf starts to wind down in the winter. You get the odd winter tour and things, and there are tours ongoing, but once he's become number one, the focus is how he deals with being what is entailed to be number one. He becomes the leading figure. He becomes a figurehead. He becomes a symbol for golfers everywhere. They analyse his swing twice more because they believed he has the best swing, because he is number one. Then analyse his putting. Anything he does wrong, so a good example of this was Tiger Woods, when we had all the scandal when he was number one, they come down much harder on him because he is representing the sport to other sports and prospective fans.
This is URN Sport.
Cricket.
Right, now moving swiftly on to, of course, the Ashes summer that we just barely managed to win. I say that, you know, I was very gutted to not be at the fourth Test match. Of course, we'll move on to that later on. But I just want to give you a quick rundown of all of the Test matches. Now, obviously, the first Test, England won by 169 runs. It was the first match under new coach Trevor Bayliss, obviously. And yeah, you know, it was from what I saw of them, the way that they play, you know, I'm a massive cricket fan, and I really enjoyed watching England play in the first Test.
He selected them well.
Yeah, he definitely selected them well, obviously. Joe Root with the pick of the bunch in the batting with 134 runs off of 250 balls, which was, I think, the key moment in the match. Definitely one of the innings that perhaps won us the...
It defined the Ashes.
Oh yeah, definitely. Now Australia had a fight back in the second innings with Mitchell Johnson making 77 runs, but unfortunately it was too little too late for Australia. We then moved on to the second Test, where Australia came out fighting with a point to prove. You know, they were all guns blazing. Smith with a double century, which was...
I was pleased he got it.
It was absolutely incredible. And of course Chris Rogers with 173, and you know, we absolutely got annihilated in the second Test by 405 runs. Now guys, just before we move on to the third Test, if you were on the England team and having, you know, won the first Test quite so easily and then to be absolutely hammered in the second Test, what would your mentality have been going into the third Test match?
It probably would have been that, you know, the answer is improvement and there's kind of nothing else that can happen, really. I mean, it couldn't have got any worse, I don't think, after the end of the second Test. I mean, you know, as you said, it was a complete and utter annihilation by Australia of the England team. But then, you know, you look at that for the first Test in Cardiff, and it was, yeah, you know, England were dominant. So there were positives and negatives to take out those first two Tests.
So moving on to the third Test, obviously England, what we won the third Test by 8 wickets, and the pick of the bowlers was obviously Jimmy Anderson taking 6 in the first innings and Stephen Finn taking 6 in the second innings. So, you know, England's bowling attack is absolutely over the summer has been absolutely amazing. So now moving on to the fourth Test, which obviously the infamous Test. I was so gutted that I didn't wake up in the morning to go down to Trent Bridge and watch it.
Did you have a ticket?
I didn't know, but I was willing to wake up in the morning and, you know, queue for hours on end. But for those of you who didn't watch it, obviously Stuart Broad, England were without Jimmy Anderson for that Test. You know, everyone was worried, eyes were on worried. Stuart Broad going into the game. Stuart Broad was on 299 Test match wickets, and you know, he said before the game he'll be delighted to get one wicket, and little did he or anyone else in the ground, anyone in the cricket,
I don't think anyone expected
Stuart Broad to come out and get 8 wickets and bowl Australia, and for England to bowl Australia all out for 60 in the first innings is just, you know, it's absolutely unheard of in an Ashes Test, isn't it?
An hour and a half, didn't it? Yeah. 2 hours.
Yeah. I left to get a cup of tea. There were 2 down, and there were 6 down by the time I got back.
I'll go for worse than that, because I was in I was on holiday at that point. I was in China, and it was 10:30 at night, and I left the computer on, and it was just about to start, and I thought, well, I'm really tired. I went to bed, woke up a couple of hours later, remembered I'd left the computer on and thought, you know what, I'll just go and check on the cricket. And the 10th wicket fell roughly as I tuned into BBC BBC Sport.
I mean, the commentators for that day were just, I remember listening on Radio 5 Live, they were just stunned. I mean, I think a third 11 team could have batted better than Australia batted.
Now obviously England did go on to win that match, thank God that they did, by an innings and 78 runs, and we did manage to regain the Ashes, leading the series 3-1, which obviously Australia couldn't beat us. So in the fifth test, Australia went out with a bang. You know, they went out 481 all out in the first innings. Steve Smith with 143 from 392. Steve Smith arguably Australia's best player over the summer, and England were forced to follow on by Australia, and of course Australia won by an innings and 46 runs.
This is URN Sport.
Men's football.
Yes, welcome back to the URN Sunday special sports show, and we are swiftly moving on to the men's football, and obviously the Premier League started over the summer, and you know, it's fantastic that it's back, and obviously Leicester, West Ham got off to flying starts after six games. They were both on 12 points, and obviously Leicester were the only unbeaten team in the Premier League until yesterday when they did lose against Arsenal, but West Ham drawing again yesterday, you know, it's just been a fantastic start from both of the two teams, wouldn't you say?
It's crazy, isn't it? It's sort of classic, sort of consistent form, I guess, and it's just random, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, those games against Arsenal, where you know that you had that 16-year-old kid, Reece Oxford, playing, who did really, really well at Anfield, where you know, where those two goals. I mean, they've had those two, Kouyaté and Payet, have been instrumental, I think, in their in their successes at the start of this season. So they just need to kind of sort out their games that they should be winning. I mean, against Leicester and Bournemouth.
Joe, just to touch on the point you made earlier about key players on West Ham. Now, obviously for Leicester City, Riyad Mahrez, what an instrumental player he's been so far, and you know, he's been key to how they've managed to stay in sixth place so early on in the season. You know, he's been scoring goals and getting assists and creating chances here, there and everywhere. And how instrumental do you think it is that they have someone like that on their team, and how important do you think it is that they try and keep him there come the next transfer window?
I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, the start of the season he's made has been brilliant, and some of the goals that he's scored are absolutely out of this world. That left one is just magical, really, isn't it? And it sets up, you know, the key thing is with Mahrez and the Leicester midfield players like Albrighton and Drinkwater, they're able to feed Vardy, and you know, he's got the pace to run onto these balls and run onto these crosses and put them away, because he's in fine form at the moment as well. You just saw, although they lost quite convincingly to Arsenal yesterday,
I think Leicester on their day, if they had a good day, they could have easily put three or four past Arsenal. You know, Petr Cech played well yesterday, but yeah, you know, going back to Leicester City and what a start they've had, obviously Joe mentioned it as well, Jamie Vardy, there's been a lot of discussion in the studios about whether or not we should be picking Jamie Vardy to play for the national side, play for England, you know, because if Roy Hodgson wants to move away from, you know, just having a typical England 11 and go towards the people who are playing in form, why not play the likes of Jamie Vardy? You know, I totally full on agree with the fact that he should perhaps give him a chance, play him in a couple of the qualifiers, because you know, obviously England have already qualified for the European Championships next year. Why not give Vardy and, you know, some youngsters a chance? Obviously Man City started off the season well, didn't perform so well yesterday. The loss against Tottenham, which was an absolute surprise. But, you know, five wins so far. And, you know, what do you guys make of City's season so far? Are they the title-winning team that we saw from last season, or is there improvement still to be made?
I'd say there is improvement still to be made. But despite yesterday's result, they've been very convincing up to now. I mean, signings like Sterling and De Bruyne, obviously three goals in three games, they've all settled in very well. Again, like with West Ham, I'd say it was individual errors.
Now, looking, you talk about City obviously trying to win the championship again. If we look back at last year's Premier League champions, Chelsea, not got off to a great start. Obviously, it's been this whole thing about Diego Costa, but you know, I think that there's more to it than just perhaps Diego Costa. I don't think that Hazard hasn't hit his best form yet. Fabregas hasn't hit his best form, and now obviously without Diego Costa for the next couple of games, they don't really have a striker who can score goals. And you know, they find themselves sitting 15th in the table after seven games with only two wins, and you know, it's not that great, is it?
We were laughing yesterday because all the strikers that we could think of, the ones we could name that were doing really well last season, they had a bad run of form. They weren't scoring. Sanchez, Aguero, lots and lots and lots of players. And the only one on that list that didn't manage to score yesterday was Hazard. and I think he's been a shadow of his former self. And he's, and we've seen glimpses, we've seen him a couple of times display the skills and the talent, but he's not put it together. And is that because ever since he took that knock against Swansea, two problems have come up for Chelsea. One is that Hazard hasn't been playing well, and two has been that when the doctor came on, that was her last impact for the club.
I think that's another big thing, the Evie Canieri saga, and the kind of hate campaign that Jose Mourinho kind of feels from not only the referees with decisions he's felt that's gone against Chelsea, but also sort of just from the media and from football fans generally. I think, you know, obviously after winning the title, everyone else is out to beat you. But I feel that Chelsea have kind of continued in the methods that they displayed last season in the hope that that will make them succeed in this one. Whereas Manchester City have rebolted their squad, you know, kind of had a bit of a rocket up there at their backside, really, in terms of, you know, improving.
I mean, we can talk about Chelsea. I'm sure we can talk about Chelsea for the entirety of the show, but quite frankly, we don't have time. And who really wants to talk about Chelsea?
Agreed.
So we're going to move and look at the top of the table, who, surprisingly, you know, Man United sit at the top of the Premier League.
Why is that surprising?
I mean, the reason I say it's surprising is because, you know, after the whole catastrophe that was David Moyes' saga, and, you know, him not really doing as well as perhaps he should have done, bringing in Louis van Gaal, getting into the Champions League last season, and then, you know, buying 18-year-old Anthony Martial for 36 million.
But they were doing decently before they signed Martial.
Oh, yeah, don't get me wrong.
Not,
I mean,
it's not to say that they've been more impressive than we thought they would this summer, because last year we were saying throughout the year on URN Sport, we're surprised that United are as high up as they are. Mm. They might finish fourth, but that would surprise us. And when you look at the starts of the season this season, and they're back up there. They are back up there amongst the three or four teams that you would expect to be in the top four for most of the season. And is that a bad thing for the Premier League?
I mean,
probably.
The main reason also why I said that I was surprised is obviously the whole David De Gea situation over the summer. You know, perhaps that might have bled over into the start of the season, and, you know, United fans and, of course, the players might not have felt, especially defenders, might not have felt as secure with Sergio Romero in goal.
Romero was very shaky, I remember, against Swansea. Mm. He didn't have a very good game at all. His kicking, I think, let him down quite a lot. And I thought that Manchester United were, towards the very start of the season, were quite lucky. I mean, that opening game against Tottenham, that Kyle Walker in goal, was quite fortunate. But yeah, I think since the David De Gea contract has been settled, they've looked a much more comfortable outfit. And these, you know, the new signings like Depay, who obviously scored his first goal yesterday, Darmian looks quite steady at the back. You've also got Schweinsteiger, who is obviously a proven world-class player. Maybe we haven't seen the best of him yet.
Obviously, David, now we come to the topic of Arsenal. Where do you think that they, you know, why aren't they performing how they should be able to perform with the team that they've got? Is it perhaps that they're lacking someone who will be solid at the back and, you know, lead the team from the back? Or is it perhaps that they don't have a recognised striker? You know, Wenger's playing around with Giroud and Walker up front. Do you perhaps feel that they need someone who can go out there and get, and, you know, is guaranteed goal scorer?
I mean, without winning every game of the season, which of course no one has ever, will ever, or can ever do realistically, I don't think Arsenal's start to the season has been at all bad, given these issues that make it seem like, you know, we're doing a Newcastle and we need to sign a striker quite badly. If you look at two decisions that have gone against Arsenal, and to give them more points than they've got, the Ramsey goal against Liverpool that was wrongly ruled out for offside. Again, it was a tough call and he got it wrong, and I'm not going to, you know, that goes in and say the game stays as it does, and that's 1-0. And the Chelsea game, you've got to assume they're going to take a point at least from that if Costa goes off. You know, that's putting them, if not at the top, clear at the top. And if that's a bad start to the season, then I'll take that over starts to the season where we lose 2-0 at home to Liverpool and then 8-2 away at Manchester United and then 4-3 away at Blackburn is, I think, probably a more embarrassing result that people forget.
There was the 2-0 as well on the opening day against West Ham, wasn't there?
That was this city, yeah. And that was well played by West Ham. They got their tactics right. And as we've said earlier when we were talking about West Ham, they're playing very, very well in games you wouldn't expect them to play well in, and perhaps it's that I don't think
they kind of caught Arsenal off guard, maybe a little bit.
They definitely caught Arsenal off guard, given how well Arsenal were playing. And they won five in a row in pre-season, conceded one in that time. You know, Arsenal hadn't had a bad start to the season, but probably Arsenal and Liverpool underestimated West Ham, and then you can't say that would happen a third time for Man City. But maybe it did.
Now, obviously, if we look at the other end of the spectrum, look at the other end of the table in the Premier League, we've got struggling Sunderland and, of course, struggling Newcastle. You know, both Tyneside teams is there really anything else that Dick Advocaat can do apart from, you know, admit defeat?
It's definitely a case of if they go one goal down and they admit defeat straight away. We've seen that on numerous occasions this season. And I'd say that it's issues at the back with John O'Shea, the likes of John O'Shea and Wes Brown. You know, maybe there's not that kind of imperious sort of centre back figure who's at the peak of their career. I mean, both of those are, you know, nearing the end of their careers now. But I'd say Jermaine Defoe is still a decent striker. I mean, you've got Fletcher as well, who, when fit, you know, can put goals away. Jack Rodwell as well is quite good in centre midfield. So I think there is hope for them.
Well, anyway, moving away from the Premier League now and just quickly touching on England's qualification for the European Championship next year. Now, obviously, I'm pretty sure that most of us in the studio would have watched the two qualifying games over the summer. Now, you say unfortunately, I mean, obviously it was a huge milestone for Wayne Rooney, scoring his 50th goal for England and overtaking Bobby Charlton as the leading goal scorer for England. You know,
if Rooney were this talisman that England needed, this centre forward that England needed, he would have crossed 50 goals a long time ago. And because he had the ability, and in terms of the goal scoring form of Harry Kane, when Rooney first came onto the scene, the amount of goals that Harry Kane has been scoring for England, it was roughly the same form as Rooney. And it's dropped off to the fact that, to break the record, he scored his third penalty against San Marino out of 5 goals against them, and he scored another penalty against Switzerland. And that's not to say that you can't do that. Of course, that's a pointless.
I feel like Rooney's obviously, throughout his career, his role has changed enormously. I mean, when we saw him burst onto the scene as an 18-year-old in Euro 2004, he was this out-and-out striker with bundles of energy, a really accurate, powerful shot, very strong. Whereas now he's kind of evolved into this sort of centre attacking midfield role, you know, where he looks for passes out wide. You know, he comes back and helps the defence. So there's a lot less of him, you know, maybe going for a goal and being that 20 goal a striker that he maybe was sort of, well, I don't know, sort of 6-7 years ago maybe. But his role's completely changed, and I think in that way it is an achievement. But like you said, he was such a talisman back when he first burst onto the scene. So in that sense, yeah, maybe he should have done it a long time ago.
This is URN Sport.
Women's football.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Sports Special. And now moving on, we are going to be talking about, obviously, the women's football. Now, the Women's Football World Cup took place earlier on in the summer in Canada. And, I mean, you know, what an advertisement for the sport of women's football. You know, I didn't think that I'd watch as many games as I did. You know, it was an absolutely amazing tournament. And England's women were impressive in the group stages. Obviously, they didn't win the group, but they did finish second behind France in the group, which, you know, I think that the women can definitely be proud of that. And then we went on to beat Norway in the round of 16, 2-1. We also went on to beat Canada 2-1 in the quarterfinal, which, you know, I was thoroughly impressed by the performance there. Obviously, Canada beat the England women's in the final warm-up game before the tournament, so, you know, there was questions about whether or not we could actually go on and beat them in the tournament. And then in the semi-final, obviously, Japan, the reigning women's world champions, managed to beat us 2-1. That was a thoroughly disappointing game. You know, I think we deserved definitely more from that game. We definitely deserved to take it into extra time. And then, luckily, you know, in the third place playoff, we managed to beat Germany. And I certainly wouldn't have seen us beating Germany before the tournament. And, you know, to come away with a bronze medal, to make history as the England women's football team, you know, it's definitely a step in the right direction, don't you think, David?
Well, England were the best women, the best European team at that World Cup. They beat Germany. The only European team they didn't manage to beat was France. And even then, that was a draw, I think, or they might have lost 1-0. It was one of the opening games of the tournament. It was a really good game. And right throughout the start of the tournament, there are a couple of us on URN Sports saying, you know, we should really watch this. Yes, it's on late at silly hours of the morning, but the football isn't half bad. And really, you've got to look at it and say, yeah, okay, they got through the group stage, not too impressive, came second, fine. Beat Norway 2-1 with a cracking goal from Lucy Bronze, edge of the area, curled it right into the top corner. Canada in the quarterfinals, battling performance, really good win. Semi-finals, Japan, and that was one of the most depressing games of football I've ever watched. England did. I don't think they deserve to take it to extra time. I think they deserve to be 3-0 up by half time. They really deserve to
do much more than that. And the fact that it was one of England's best players in the tournament to score an own goal in the 93rd minute to knock you out of the World Cup set, well, I say knock you out, they still went to the third place playoff, but to remove your chance of playing in a World Cup final against the USA, the best women's team of all time, and Germany run them close, but it's always been America. I can't imagine what that must have felt like, because I've never felt that with an England men's team.
This is URN Sport.
Rugby.
Right, now, so I think Harry can finally get back and involved in the talk.
God.
Sorry that we took so long talking about football. But
football, I mean, obviously, my existence, that.
Obviously, the game that we're all here to talk about is possibly the biggest game of the World Cup so far between two of the home nations.
Most
obviously,
upsetting game
England
of the world so far.
And Wales. If you missed it, England did lose in upsetting fashion. It was 28-25, was it? Or yeah, it was absolutely heartbreaking for me, and of course many England fans around the world. Yeah, Harry, what was your take on the game? I mean, obviously it was going to be a nervous game, you know, no having been drawn in a group with England, Wales and Australia, you know that this is going to be the crunch game, because Australia are arguably the best team in the world. For either England or Wales to beat them, it's going to take something special.
It's going to take a solid effort.
Both teams came into this game, you know, with the effort that if they can win this, then they have a chance of going through in second place. Now, what do you think that will do for England's confidence going into the next game, obviously against Australia?
It's going to worry them. It is. I'm not going to lie. I went to see Australia, Fiji, and when they first started, and even their first match, Australia looked superb. And then, of course, they played yesterday, and they've got the highest score. They got 63 points against, I believe it was Uganda.
It was Uruguay.
Uruguay, yeah. 63 points. I mean, they just ran past them. And my worry is, and what infuriated me so much about the Wales game last night, was that England had a lot of opportunities, and it was just ill discipline, or they dropped the ball, or the set piece wasn't working. Silly things that, if they were against Australia, I'm afraid Australia would have taken the ball and gone, thank you very much, and walked past them.
If they want to perhaps get a couple of bonus points out of it, if at best they only get two bonus points, where do you think that they need to improve on?
Ultimately, they gave away too many penalties. They went through into the second half with a 10-point lead. Within, like, 4 minutes, it had gone back to 7 points because someone had given away a penalty, and then all it needed was a try, which they then scored, and then you're back to square one. And you've put all that effort in for 40 minutes, and to give it away by playing it on the floor in front of the referee, or dropping the ball, or just shoving someone in the back, was just... I mean, they're meant to be a national team, play to a national standard. Discipline wise, they played so well against Fiji. Yeah, okay, they were a bit rough, but they didn't give nearly as many penalties away. And you can't do that. You could afford to do it against Fiji. You couldn't afford to do it against Wales. You certainly won't be able to afford to do it against Australia. And I don't think Wales gave away nearly as many penalties, or if so, nearly as stupid penalties as England did.
Now, just quickly, just to wrap up the rugby talk. A very quick question. Who do you guys think will win this Rugby World Cup?
It's going to come down between Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah. I was going to say.
And it'll be tight, because New Zealand weren't playing as well as they have done.
I think the other sort of heavyweights, really, obviously England, bad start. Wales.
France have played well.
France have played well, actually.
Ireland have looked very good as
South Africa, obviously, defeat against Japan is kind of,
They're going to have no problem getting out of that group. But no, France are a contender. They played very well.
This is URN Sport.
Athletics.
Hello and welcome back. And we're moving into our final section of the show. And we're going to be talking a bit about the World Athletics Championships that occurred over the summer. Now, I'm not sure how much you guys watched of the Athletics Championships. I definitely sat down and watched quite a bit of it. And, you know, there really isn't any other talking point to start with than, you know, obviously Usain Bolt. Well, you know, he managed to just beat Justin Gatlin by, what was it, 100th of a second in the 100-metre race before winning, of course, the 200-metre race. And, you know, he's gone on to win 10 World Championship goals now. So, you know, it's just absolutely incredible. What was your opinion on the races, Harry?
I mean, my opinion was that you had all the media thing beforehand saying, like, he'll save the sport, he'll save the reputation of the sport, because the whole allegation against Gatlin's doping and whether or not it should have been allowed back. And at the end of the day, I think they sort of, the media certainly lost the idea that it wasn't about that. It was about the fact that you've got the fastest men in the world lining up to sprint 100 meters in under 10 seconds. And that is what it should be about. It should be about that, not about who wins. And if Gatland won, yes, he's the best. He was the better sprinter on the day.
I mean, he's such a—he's just generally quite a kind of a world icon now, isn't he? He's you know, does those Virgin adverts with Richard Branson. He could go on to do literally anything.
Yeah, he could go on to do absolutely anything.
Now, so. You talk about icons of the sport. Obviously, Britain's golden girl, Jessica Ennis-Hill. You know, she won the heptathlon gold to add to her Olympic gold from 2012. Now, there was a few doubts going into the tournament whether or not she would be competing. Obviously, she had earlier in the year had a little baby boy called Reggie. And you know, I think one of the overlooked athletes as well was Katarina Johnson-Thompson, who looked on target for finishing perhaps in second or third place. But you know, after failing to register a long jump distance, you know, that really was the competition over for her. What are your guys' takes on, you know, the Jessica Ennis-Hill? Will she be able to be doing this next year in the Rio 2016 Olympics, or do you think that perhaps Katarina Johnson-Thompson might, you know, move forward and overtake her as one of the best athletes in the world?
I mean, Katarina Johnson-Thompson, the one she failed on, her last attempt, was about a centimetre over the board. It was so close, they had to go back and look at it again. So I was disappointed for her, because she'd done such a good heptathlon, such good times beforehand. And as regards Jessica Ennis, I mean, credit to her, really, to come back from having a son. You'd think she'd probably, maybe people were expecting her to hang up the towel. And I think well done for her to prove for people that you don't have to hang up the towel in a major sport having had a child if you're dedicated enough to get back to the physical fitness and physique and sort of mentality that you had beforehand. So I think she should go for the 16. I can't see her continuing any on past the 2016 Rio Olympics. I mean, but she's been fantastic for the heptathlon.
Now, obviously, going back to a point that you made earlier, Harry, about Justin Gatlin and doping, you know, there was several allegations before the World Championships of Mo Farah, the whole doping scene with him, but he managed to, you know, just ignore that, put all that stuff behind him. You know, he's cleared of that now, and you know, to come back from all of those allegations and to prove all of the critics wrong and to go on and win both the 5,000 and 10,000 meter gold. They're calling it in the sport the triple double. He's won both events at the Olympics and now in the World Championships in 2013 and 2015, you know, such a great achievement. Now, obviously, moving on to the final British athlete who, you know, again impressed at a major tournament, and that's Greg Rutherford, who won the long jump and now holds the Olympic, European, Commonwealth and World Championship gold medals, and he won the World Championship gold medal with a fourth round jump of 8.41 metres. Now, both of you guys, how do you think that, you know, the modern day athlete now, obviously for Britain, you know, having impressed so well in London 2012, and you know, do you think that they can go on and inspire more people of a younger generation to try and get into athletics who perhaps are, you know, shying away and not so good at other mainstream sports that, you know, that want to turn to athletics? How do you think that Britain doing so well in these championships are going to affect it?
There was the big issue, obviously, of the legacy after London 2012, wasn't there? Where, you know, kids and just people throughout the UK were
getting involved.
Getting involved more into sport, and you know, obviously the fact that we did so well, collected so many medals, came third in the medals table, has a massive impact upon participation, which is what we want and what we need to continue, because our successes in recent years in athletics and, you know, all Olympic sports, really, in many disciplines, from cycling to hockey to all these sorts of things, have just been phenomenal and keep improving generally. And we really need to keep that going and keep that sort of chain of success going, I think.
This is URN Sport.
Boxing.
Now we're moving on to our final topic of the day, and that is, of course, boxing. Now, for many of you guys who don't really know a lot about boxing, it was, of course, Floyd Money Mayweather's final fight against Andre Berto. He beat him on points, took him to 49 straight wins, equaling the record set by Rocky Marciano. Now, guys, I just want your opinions on Floyd Mayweather as a personality, and as, you know, how he's changed the sport, and, you know, what effect do you think it's going to have on other potential candidates who are going to come up and, you know, try and challenge for his title? Do you guys think that, you know, Mayweather, obviously he's had a positive impact on the sport, but, you know, do you think that he's perhaps monetized the sport a bit too much?
He is certainly there are two ways you can look at him. One, he's given it his sort of personal representation and how he fights and sort of the pre-match banter with the people and sort of his sort of physicality when in the boxing ring. I want to say it's all part of the experience, but he has taken it slightly too far with the amount he's earned and things like that.
Now, obviously, moving on to talking about someone who could perhaps potentially overtake him as the best boxer in the world, we have Anthony Joshua, who's now currently unbeaten in 14 fights. You know, guys, they say he's not really fought up against anyone of you know, known names, but, you know, you can only beat who is put in front of you. You know, you can't, as a boxer, you've only got so much control over who you face in your next fight. His coach has come out and said that, you know, he'll be ready for a title fight in perhaps 5 or 6 fights. Do you see him becoming, you know, one of the best British boxers around, if not one of the best boxers in the world?
Boxing is very sort, it's very up and down. It depends how you are on the day. It depends how the opposition is on the day. It's obviously quite a skill, but there's quite a bit of luck involved. I'd like to think. Can he go on? 14 fights is a long way off from 49.
Mm.
But the fact that, do we know how young Mr. Joshua is?
He's still young.
Yeah,
early 20s.
Well, I mean, I think his coach has taken the right choice, not saying, oh yeah, he can do a title fight right now. I think, see how he goes. If he loses the next two, then we'll see where it takes him. But I think for Britain, we do need some decent boxers. So it'll be interesting to see how he does in the future.